From Austin Film Festival and PRI, this is On Story, a look inside the creative process from today's leading writers and filmmakers. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. This week on Story, we'll hear from podcast pioneers on breaking into a new medium and adapting audio stories for television.
They're looking for intellectual property right now any way they can. And so, yeah, podcasts, they're very excited about it right now. And the iron is definitely hot.
And later we'll hear from rising television talent Misha Green on her work co-creating the critically acclaimed genre-bending drama Underground.
I think that for me, everything kind of turns into a thriller. My obsession a little bit as a writer is what we're willing to do for metaphorical and physical survival.
On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. We'll be back in a moment. Austin Film Festival's On Story is supported in part by Final Draft, industry standard screenwriting software that now includes extensive story planning tools. Find out more information about Final Draft 10 at finaldraft.com. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. Narrative fiction podcasts have updated the radio drama with a modern streamable twist. This new medium has attracted storytellers who until recently never considered telling strictly audio stories. Writers Lauren Shippen, who created The Bright Sessions, and Jenny Turner Hall, who created The Unexplainable Disappearance of Maurice Battelle, discussed their transition into podcasting and the new opportunities that their shows have provided them.
Would you guys start us off by kind of giving us a short history of your journey as a writer and how you got into podcast writing?
So I actually came to writing an interesting way, which was as an actor. I've been living out in LA now for about 4.5 years and was kind of getting frustrated with the roles that were available to me as a 20-something woman. It's a lot of, you know, romantic opposite of the lead male or just sort of the sidekick. And I was seeing a lot of fellow actors in my acting class at the time who were super, super talented and really interesting and just were not getting jobs. And so I decided that I wanted to make my own thing, and I knew how much money it cost to make a web series. So I thought, okay, I'll make a fiction podcast. And so I started The Bright Sessions, which is about people with supernatural abilities and therapy.
I just, I saw your listing in the paper and it looked intriguing. That's all.
What about it intrigued you?
Well, therapy for the strange and unusual. It sounded, well, unusual.
And we've now done 41 episodes and been downloaded over 7 million times, and it's just been quite a journey.
That's a big deal, that number.
I can't wrap my head around it. It's crazy.
7 million. Wow. My background is playwriting and screenwriting. But Maurice Battelle came out of a need to cobble a career together. I used to work for the Directors Guild, and I had 2 kids, and I couldn't afford childcare, so I stayed at home with the kids, and I needed to figure out how to pick up the pieces of my career and what can I do from home. And so podcasting presented itself. I ran an Algonquin Circle style artist salon out of my basement because I had postpartum depression. And I needed to connect with fellow artists in the suburbs, you know, for my own well-being. And I met the guys that I did Maurice Battelle with. We had an idea that there wasn't a lot in the space scripted podcast-wise for kids. So I wanted to create something that I could enjoy with my kids. So really, Maurice Battelle came out of that impulse.
Have you ever wondered what you would do if your friends went missing?
5 days since Aurora disappeared. She isn't responding to text or calls. 9.
Why, you're just a kid. What could you do?
8. She said she'd be right out, and then she wasn't.
7. What would it really take to bring them back?
6. It still doesn't make any sense. Where did she go?
3. 2. 1.
So with both of these ideas, Bright Sessions and Maurice Battelle, were they ideas that from the minute you had the idea, the format in your head was podcast?
So I did Maurice Battelle with 3 other dudes, And I have to say it was Ben Strauss's idea specifically to do it as a podcast. He was savvy enough to notice that there was a gap in the market for scripted podcasts for children and for middle grade specifically. So not for young kids, but not for teenagers, right in between. So I think he saw that there was potential there. And then when you do projects for that age group, you can start, I mean, if you're really dreaming big, you can start thinking about franchise because you think about Harry Potter. And really, Harry Potter was a big model for this. But I didn't think podcast at first. I think what I thought was probably TV.
It definitely did start as a podcast for me because I was listening to Welcome to Night Vale and it was one guy with a microphone and was so successful, I thought, okay, I can do that. Like, I know enough about recording sound. I was a music major in college, so I did a little bit of that, even though I was mostly live music. And I wanted to be able to do every aspect of the production by myself. And so even involving other actors seemed like too big of an ask. And so I came up with this character of Sam Barnes, who's the character that I play in the podcast, who time travels when she has panic attacks. And that character, it was just initially going to be kind of her journals. And she came out of my own panic disorder and was a very personal story. And then I realized that the reason Night Vale works is because it's Cecil Baldwin's voice and the writing that it is. It's very surrealist and it's got Disperson's music. It's this kind of lightning in a bottle thing. And I was not going to recreate that. And so I needed to give her somebody to talk to. And then I thought, okay, well, maybe she's talking to a therapist. And then like the floodgates opened and all of a sudden there was a whole other story on top of this small character story that I was trying to tell. And then it was about making it just about the therapy so that I could still just do it in my bedroom and only ask a couple of actors. Our initial cast was just me and three other actors that I worked with in class and was very close to and felt not terrible about asking them to do it for free at first. And now we have a cast of 12 and everybody's getting paid, you know, a pittance, but everybody's getting paid. And we still record in my bedroom. We just sort of cram more people in there.
Obviously, radio drama isn't new, but I think one of the things that's so exciting about the fiction podcast world is there are kind of different rules. And it seems like the audiences, the more successful podcasts are using a narrator or a premise for why you'd be hearing the audio. They don't just drop you in the story.
Well, if you're going to use a narrator, you got to make the narrator a character. So we made Oliver Pruitt a big part of the story. And you never know whether he's evil or if he's good. I mean, we knew our audience was going to be mostly kids, of course, but adults who have to, you know, are stuck listening to it in the car with their kids. So, you know, we knew that kids might get confused. So it was really going to be important that we have a narrator. But yeah, we had a long discussion about that. We're like, how can we do this without it being cheesy? And so we decided to create someone who is an unreliable narrator. That was our way of tackling it. And my friend Michael, who plays Oliver Pruitt, puts on a fake British accent that's supposed to sound fake. A lot of people don't know. They're like, what part of England is he from? Michael's from South Orange, New Jersey, just demystifying. That's where Oliver Pruitt's from. But it was very deliberate and really thoughtful how we were going to do that. We also had this idea of wanting kids to have an interactive element with the podcast. So for a while, we created a website for Pruitt Prep, the fake school, that kids could apply to get into when they're listening to the podcast. And they're a little unsure whether Pruitt Prep is real or fake. And we set up a hotline, a phone number. They're in crisis. They could call the hotline. And the messages were hysterical because the kids really believe Pruitt Prep's a real place. And it was heartbreaking. They're like, how do I apply to Pruitt Prep? I've talked to my parents about it. They're okay with me going to boarding school.
Awesome. Well, let's talk about the podcast to screen process. If you guys will, talk about your journey from when you released the podcast to now what you're looking ahead to.
Yeah. So earlier this year, you know, we'd been releasing the podcast for about a year and a half, and we were in the middle of our third season. And I had sort of been talking to a couple people in LA about, you know, maybe developing a TV version of the Bright Sessions because it was gaining a lot of traction and it had been named on, you know, a bunch of best 2016 lists and sort of was getting more and more popular. And then Dark Horse Entertainment reached out to me and said that they were interested in talking to me about producing it. And I met with them and they just really got what it was. They got that it was not just your standard superhero story, because there's plenty of that out there, especially on TV, but that it's ultimately about like emotions and relationships, and it's about the day-to-day lives of these people. And so they helped me develop a pitch, and then I pitched to UCP, and then UCP optioned it, and that's kind of where we're at now. And so I'm working with UCP, Universal Cable Productions, and Gabrielle Stanton, who is a veteran TV writer and showran Haven and wrote on The Flash. She was sort of paired up with me with UCP, and she, again, like I met her and I talked with her, and she'd listened to the podcast, and she just really got what it was. And so we've got a pitch right now that I'm super, super excited about, and we're going to be, taking it out to networks and whatnot. But it's been a really weirdly fun and validating process in a way I was not expecting it to be, because I was sort of went into it kind of, with my skepticism glasses on.
I feel like we just went out and got our opportunities. We didn't wait for anyone to discover, and we reached out to anyone and everyone that we knew. We're trying to find a showrunner. I mean, we're in, development hell, as they say. So, that's where we're at. They're looking for intellectual property right now any way they can. And so, yeah, podcasts, they're very excited about it right now. And the iron is definitely hot. So it's definitely the time to try to, introduce your scripted material out there. I think I would say the same thing about playwrights and playwriting. It's kind of the same idea. Just they're looking for new voices, something fresh that they haven't heard.
One of the things that stands out to me from even how you got where you are, and one of the things that across the board I think we've seen with our panelists for our podcast track, is just this entrepreneurial spirit. Like, it sounds like you guys both got here because you were tired of waiting for permission to tell your stories. And can you talk a little bit about that feeling and that decision? Was it scary to just be like, I'm just going to do it?
Yeah, it was terrifying. I wrote the first script for the Bright Sessions in 2014 and didn't do anything with it for a year. Because I was like, I'm not a writer, I'm an actor. I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know how to make a podcast. And then I just got, really impatient. And these characters wouldn't leave me alone. And I started talking to some actors about it. And yeah, it was really, releasing that first episode was really scary. But it also, the stakes were so low, which was really nice. Just because, it didn't cost us anything. We were doing it for fun. And if nobody listened, nobody listened, And that would have been fine. There was kind of nothing to lose.
I mean, I love podcasts for all the same reasons. I mean, I feel like it's a really democratic medium. I mean, that's what's cool about it. Yes, I will concede that in order to take it to the next level, you have to draw upon some connections or make them. So it's still part of the business. So you got to deal with that. But the fact that you can do it on such a low budget, and if you have even a little bit more money, well, all the better. I mean, it's a beautiful thing. It's just, honestly, just go do it.
Support for On Story comes from Loyola Marymount University School of Film and Television. Ranked a top 10 film school by USA Today and The Hollywood Reporter. Offering graduate degrees in screenwriting, production, and writing and producing for TV. Visit sftv.lmu.edu. Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. We'll be back in a moment. Austin Film Festival's On Story is supported in part by Final Draft, industry standard screenwriting software that now includes extensive story planning tools. Find out more information about Final Draft 10 at finaldraft.com. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. Next up, we'll hear from television writer and showrunner Misha Green. Green began her career as a staff writer on FX's hit drama Sons of Anarchy and NBC's cult sci-fi series Heroes. Green later went on to co-create Underground, which chronicled a group of Georgia slaves who escaped bondage to find freedom via the Underground Railroad. The series broke ratings records for the WGN network and was nominated for several awards. Misha Green spoke with filmmaker Yaki Smith at the 2017 Austin Film Festival. Clips courtesy of Safe House Pictures, Get Lifted Film Company, and Sony Pictures Television.
I went to NYU and I made a disastrous short film and was like, ugh, film school, I hate this. And then you graduate and you've paid a ton of money to go to NYU. And my parents were like, so you wanted to go this route. What are we doing now? And I was like, I'm working in a restaurant. It's really cool. And they were like, ooh. And so at that point, I had always been writing, but I was like, again, it was never really a thing. I was like, this is a hobby. I enjoy this. I have fun doing it. And then I was like, oh, maybe your hobby can be the thing you do for work. What does that mean? And then I moved to LA and I was like, I still have no idea what a TV show writer is, but I want to be it. So I guess I'm just going to tell a bunch of people I want to do that.
And so you sort of had a script, a feature that you wrote in 2008 that ended up on the Blacklist. Mm-hmm. And how did ending up on the Blacklist sort of help you actually get staffed in a writer's room?
Well, that was the second year of the Blacklist, and I don't think anybody knew even what it was still at that point. So it was just, they were like, one morning I remember they called me and they were like, you got on the Blacklist. And I was like, what is the Blacklist? And then they were like, it's like the best unproduced scripts in town. Like all of the execs vote on it. And I just think it's another great, you know, platform for new writers in this business. And that's what it was, a platform for me. I think once the script got on that, more people started reading the script. And it's, as I call it now, the little script that could, because I still go into meetings now and people are like, tell me about Sunflower. What's going on with it? Like, and I'm like, nothing, guys. It's 2008. I wrote it. Come on. But it's good because it in getting to TV, I think it was really also at the time when people started reading features and not just looking at spec pilots or spec TV show episodes of other TV shows. So that really got me into the room. And then, you know, being diversity, as they call it, got me in the room as well.
And what room was that you first got into?
Sons of Anarchy.
And how was that?
The Sons of Anarchy room, I feel like I literally the day before I went, I called my agent and I was like, so what does it mean to be a TV writer? What is that all about? And she was like, oh, you know, you just go in and you write. And I was like, what? And again, I realized she didn't really know what it was about. She didn't like, and that's the thing. I think you go onto staff, and I got there the first day, and I was like, I get my own office? This is crazy. And I was like, we sit in a room, and we talk about story all day. That's the dream. For me, I was just so starry-eyed and wide-eyed. I was like, yes, this is the best.
Okay, so you go from Sons of Anarchy, and then you were on Heroes, I believe, right?
Yes, Heroes.
What other shows were you on?
Spartacus and Helix, which was on Sci-Fi.
Okay. But anyway, so you have this idea for a TV show.
Yes.
And how do you pitch that, or how do you
well,
come up with that?
Well, Underground, I had Joe Pekaski, who co-created it with me. We met on Heroes. We wrote scripts together on Heroes, because sometimes they put writers who aren't writing partners together. And as opposed to being like changing every comma he made because it was really annoying, we gelled, we vibed. And I was like, you know what? I want to do a show about the Underground Railroad. Do you want to do a show about the Underground Railroad? And he was like, yeah, let's do it. And then we just started researching it. We started researching it. Then we went and pitched it. And everybody was like, nah, it's not going to be for us. And so then we wrote the pilot because we were like, well, you don't get what we want to do yet. So let's write the pilot. And we wrote the pilot, went back to people, and they were still like, nah.
Nah.
And my agent doesn't like me to tell this story, but I feel like he like called in a favor and like was like, listen, this girl's going to fire me unless you get this, pick up this pilot. And then WGN came along and they picked it up. And I'm not going to say that's who did it, but they picked it up. And that was the process.
You briefly mentioned Joe and you all sort of collaborating, but I'm interested to know, you're an African-American woman. He's a white guy, right? How do you know that he's going to really be able to understand sort of this story and the essence of it and really, really sort of capture sort of the beauty and also the trauma that comes with being a slave in the American South?
Joe is a good storyteller.
Okay.
So that's how I know. You know, I don't subscribe to the ideology that, oh, you can't write something you don't know. That doesn't make any sense. I'm like, that's why you're a writer. You write into something. And he's a good writer, and we wrote together before. So I was like, I understand that you think story the way I think story. Is every single thing that you write going to be perfect about an enslaved person in 1958? No, I feel like you could talk to a lot of historians who feel that a lot of things about underground aren't perfect. So it's that. I think that you have to be a good storytelling, and you have to have an openness to know that you don't know everything. And I think that's a lot of what gets in a lot of people's way, too, is that they're like, no, I can write women characters. And it's like, no, you can't. And maybe if you stop to think that for a second and take that in, it opens you up to being able to write good characters, because you'll take the time to go, oh, maybe I don't know how to write women. You know, I think that for me, I always constantly going, what are these white guys thinking? So I don't necessarily think I could write white guys that well, because I'm like, what? What is this?
Well, let's step back for a minute. You talked about sort of writing the spec, and I also heard that you wrote like, I think you said a 55 to 60 page Bible, right? Yeah. What was that about? I mean, you go in with this Bible, what does that look like, and sort of how do you then take that into the room with you when you're pitching?
Well, the Bible we did because, again, everybody was like, we don't understand how this is a series. This seems like, if it is anything, it's a mini-series, and that the mini-series should span the scope of the entire history of Black people, which is always like... we decided to write the Bible to kind of be like, here's where the series goes over five seasons. Here's what all these characters are. Here's what an episode looks like, just to take away all the excuses in a way, because we had heard so many. And so it was about, that's why it started to balloon to 55 pages. I do not recommend you write a 55-page Bible for anything. But that's why, because we're like, let's take away all your excuses to say that this is not a TV series. With Underground, when we were talking about Underground early on, we kept talking about Prison Break, the pilot. The show is nothing like Prison Break, the pilot, but they seemed to really like that when we said, it's like Prison Break. you know, and then they like... They would literally refer to, they were like, well, can you like change this to be like in Prison Break? And I'm like, that didn't actually happen in Prison Break though, guys, which you just asked me to do. I watched the pilot. It didn't happen in the pilot. But I think it's a little bit of that. I think it's going, here are the things that you can digest. I think it's really important not to change the things they don't understand, because you're also not necessarily making the show for the people who are greenlighting the show. And it's always a complicated thing to navigate in that, because it's a fight. You know, every single thing that happened on Underground was a fight. We had to fight for it, down to casting, because it's just your cast getting too pretty. I'm like, what does that mean? They're TV actors. Of course they're pretty.
And so you talked about doing extensive research for this show. What kind of research are you doing for a show like Underground?
I mean, I love to read. I think that's also part of being a great writer, is reading a lot. So I read just everything. I just go through and, you know, literally go on Amazon and just be like, slavery, what is there to read? Read that. And then also watching. I think you watch everything. And surprisingly, everybody's like, I'm so sick of slave stories. And I'm like, there's not that many to watch. So I don't know how we're sick of them. But then I watch them and I go, oh, I know why we're sick of them. And then also the Library of Congress, I think one of the things that really kind of cracked open Underground is they have these enslaved narratives where they interviewed people speaking about their lives in slavery. And that, to me, I just went, whoa, because then you're hearing stories about how, like, this guy, you know, didn't have a pass to go to the plantation dance, which I didn't even know existed before I started researching. And he didn't have the pass, but he wanted to see the girls, so he went anyway and took the paddling and said the paddling was worth it. And to me, I'm like, what? like, we don't hear, that's not the stories we hear about people actually living and loving and laughing. We just hear about the whippings or see the whippings. So that, I think, for me, again, and reading stuff, you know, the character of Rosalie, we read this letter this enslaved girl wrote about to run or not to run. And again, to me, I'm just like, wait, to run or not to run? Like, obviously that's a thing, but I've never seen that. That's problem put on screen and putting it into context like that. So I think for us on the show, research was so important.
And it's interesting that you say that because, you know, when you think about what you learn in school, it's usually, and I've heard you say this, it's like a paragraph or two about slavery, Harriet Tubman, and the Underground Railroad. But we really don't know how that all worked. And I think Underground does a great job of sort of showing us that. So my question then becomes, so it's not your typical slave narrative, right? I mean, it's sort of a genre film, or I should say a genre story wrapped into a slave narrative. How did you approach that and why did you decide to go that route?
I think that for me, everything kind of turns into a thriller. My obsession a little bit as a writer is what we're willing to do for metaphorical and physical survival. So I think the Underground Railroad for me, even in the love story of it, even in the heroics of it, I always kind of see that in every story I'm telling. So it just, and then naturally it fit into that when you read about, you know, the different ways people were escaping, the ingenuity they were using, the people going after them. It all kind of fit that thriller roller coaster very easily.
And it's interesting because I remember when I first watched Underground, I said, this is one of the sexiest slave narratives I've ever seen. I mean, really. And then to know that you wrote on Spartacus, I said, okay, I can kind of see that. And I guess the question with that is, was it your intention always to sort of try to rewrite the narrative of what we've known of slavery or to sort of expose us to a different part of slavery that we probably haven't been exposed to?
It's hard to say what your intention is, for me at least, when I'm doing it. When I'm doing it, I'm just trying to entertain myself, and I happen to like sexy and violent things and complicated, where you're everybody's right in the room when something's happening. But in hindsight, yes. You know what I mean? Because now I can see that I was like, in response to watching and doing research and watching all these movies in which it's portrayed in one sepia tone light, all of that infused in and this idea of giving a voice to the voiceless and seeing it again, I looked at the story and I go, this is obviously such a cool story. How have we not had millions of movies about this? And so I don't think I intended at the time that. I think it evolved into that over time.
You've cast it, you start shooting. And it's interesting because you obviously, let's step back for a minute, you form your writer's room. And this goes back to this idea of how the story evolves. But I read somewhere, and correct me if I'm wrong, that even though you had a writer's room, you wrote like 9 out of the 10 episodes for season 1, right?
So don't recommend that either.
So how did you use your room? Like, what was the room sort of doing?
I think the room, it was a bit difficult for this show because Joe and I just had a symbiosis and we could literally sit there and be like, ooh, do this and let's do that and let's go do this and we'll do that. But the room, we use the room the way that everybody uses the room, which is that we all sit there and we break every episode. We break it every episode, every scene. What's interesting, I think, is really for our room and all the people that were involved in it, it's bringing their voice to the table. And again, bringing this kind of let's push the bar, what's the crazy idea that makes total sense, but we never saw it coming. And I think that our room was really good at helping us shape the episodes that way.
And obviously you and Joe sort of share those responsibilities. So are you two both on set at all times or do you sort of...
He would be, because we were shooting like 3 units at the same time, trying to get the show finished and stuff. So he would be on one set. I'd be on one set. We'd switch sets. Sometimes he'd be back in L.A. Sometimes I'd be back in L.A. So it was kind of just... And Anthony Hemingway, who did the first 4 in season 1 and then was also executive producer season 2, it was kind of just a merry-go-round of us running around to different places all the time.
And, you know, speaking of Anthony Hemingway... How did the decision come about to actually have him direct sort of four episodes and then he comes on as a producer? Like, what was that decision like?
It was a very easy decision. Anthony came in and he said, you know, we had met with a lot of directors who brought in like sepia tone lookbooks. And I was just like, oh my God, if I see one more sepia tone lookbook with 12 Years a Slave pictures in it. And he came in with the vibe. You know, he came in with the vibe we wanted, which we were like, we want bright colors. We want all this stuff. We want this to move. We want to feel like we're actually in it and not looking at a portrait on the wall. And he came in, and it was actually pretty funny because it was like he was on set. So he came in, had to do the media at like 9:30 at night in the office. And I was just like, I'm so sick of talking to directors. And now I got to sit here till 9:30 to meet somebody. And so he came in. I was like, I'm just going to be quiet the whole time. I'm not saying anything this time. And then I was like, yay, you're the one.
What you doing in here?
Ain't this Miss George's room?
That it is.
You cargo too?
No. I just tidy up from time to time for Miss Georgia. Now, that's two questions of yours I didn't answer, and I only asked you one.
I just heard some of us might be moving on soon, and I wanted to thank her for all she done for me.
I think she's in the kitchen.
I appreciate it.
All right, so let's talk about character a little bit, because one of my favorite characters in the show is Miss Ernestine. Mm-hmm. Who I absolutely love. I love her performance, but also I just love her character. And it's interesting because one of the things that sort of we've adopted, this ideology that being a house slave was so much easier, right? Mm-hmm. You weren't in the field, you know, you're in the big house, things are easier. But you sort of debunked that stereotype with her character. And I'm curious to know, one, you already talked about the research, but when you're approaching a character like that, how do you sort of craft that narrative, you know?
How do I craft the narrative? I think it's you always have to find some of yourself in the character. And I always feel a bit of a house slave working in this industry. So I don't think it's too hard to make the leap.
What does that mean? Elaborate on that analogy.
That leap. I mean, I think that we know exactly what it means. It's like you make these products and it's you're in this industry and you're going, what am I making this product in service of? And I think that that's a lot of the stuff that we explored with Ernestine was this idea that somebody's looking at you going, you have the upper hand here. You have a vaulted position. Is that truth? Or is that false? And just because someone's saying it, does that make it true? And then you've now bought into it. Does that make it true? And I think that's, for me, was, you know, the thing. And it was very easy to explore with her and really take a time to think about it.
Support for On Story comes from Loyola Marymount University School of Film and Television. Ranked a top 10 film school by USA Today and The Hollywood Reporter, offering graduate degrees in screenwriting, production, and writing and producing for TV. Visit sftv.lmu.edu. On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI, we'll be back in a moment.
This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. We're back with television writer Misha Green. Green co-created the critically acclaimed series Underground, which ran for 2 seasons before being canceled in 2017. When we left off, Green was discussing playing with the audience's expectations when creating characters.
What character would you say was the most difficult one to figure out, if there was one?
Difficult to figure out? Noah. Okay. I'd say Noah, because I think that, you know, you have the hero being the hero, and then they have to drive the story, and they have to be interesting still. And I think that's sometimes really hard to make the, you know, Jack in Lost character interesting. And so that, I think, was the hardest to figure out. Okay.
What makes you so special? Why do you get to be here? Hell, everybody got a freedom drink. Welcome to mine.
Oh. You the one that ain't supposed to be here. I ain't leave you behind to die. I threw you something to defend yourself with because I felt sorry for you.
You felt sorry?
I ain't through yet. Now you can sit there in your pristine clothes speaking with the proper white man's tongue. And you can fool everyone else out there in the civilized world. You can fool everyone up in here, but you can't fool me. You still the snake of a slave driver you was when you left Macon.
The thing I really loved about season two, just to sort of jump from season one to season two, was how you allowed yourself...
You mean all of it? That's what you loved? No. All of it?
But what I loved is how you allowed yourself to have certain episodes, whole episodes devoted to particular characters. So we have a whole episode with Miss Ernestine, an entire episode with Cato. How did you come to that decision, and was that a sort of difficult thing to do in the sense of writing a full episode with just one person featuring that person?
No, I think, you know, personally, I found in season one, that we blasted through a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Because we were on a narrative drive, and it was about getting north, and it was about the plan of figuring out how to get off the plantation. So it felt very plot-heavy to me in season one, so it didn't take anything to step back a little bit and go a little bit deeper into character and figuring out people in season two, because we also knew going into season three that season three was going to be plot heavy as well.
And I appreciated that, because I felt like I got to know a lot about them that I hadn't known. And let's talk about this Harriet Tubman episode, which, you know, I think was a sort of a very, very different way of storytelling for television. One, how did you come to that decision to devote an entire episode to her basically in a room talking, and was that a difficult pitch to make?
I mean, it's Harriet Tubman. So I think we went, what are we going to do? And we always like to do, Joe and I, like the idea of doing kind of an out-of-the-box episode. So in season one, we did Cradle, which was from all the kids' perspective. And so we were like, what's going to be our out-of-the-box episode this season? Obviously, it seems like it should be with Harriet, because we also knew, as much as we would love the character of Harriet, she wasn't going to be prominent in every single episode. So we're like, what can we do that's going to platform her? And then we were doing research, and in the research we found that at this time in 1859 she was actually giving these speeches to like raise money for the cause. And to me, I went, Harriet Tubman was giving speeches to raise money for the cause. That's crazy, because I was like, and now you're a person to me. Now you're a person who's fundraising. And I'm like, to me, that's so interesting. And then I went, and here's a perfect chance for us to tell her entire history. Because as much as I say the show isn't historical, I knew that this was going to be some people's first entry into Harriet Tubman. So I was like, how do I feel like I've said enough about her by the end of the season? And so then that's when I was watching a TED Talk with Maya Angelou, and I was like, oh my God. And like in that TED Talk, she went to all the places. It was like 12 minutes. It wasn't a TED Talk, it was just a speech, but it was like 12 minutes of her making you cry, making you laugh, singing. And I was just like, if we could do this for an hour, we've won.
Every time I got hit, I took it as an opportunity for defiance, to not give anyone the reaction they expected. And then I thought, again, maybe that there was freedom. But I couldn't reconcile why something everybody held so precious come from pain. There had to be an easier way to it than that.
No one believed we were going to do that. So when we said episode six is going to be all Harriet Tubman talking, and they were like, yeah, yeah, yeah. Like even Aisha Hines, who love my life, she didn't believe it. She was like, uh-huh, sure. Okay, great. Everybody thought we would put flashbacks in it. And then we, season two, we were really behind. We were under the gun. We were shooting out an 8 months pregnant star. So we were shooting all out of order, and we had some days that were over, so we kept taking from this episode because we were going to shoot episode six last. So we were like, okay, well, we need this day to shoot this now. We need this day to shoot this now. And then we got down to 3 days left, that we only had 3 days to shoot it. And then we got a week and a half out, and we hadn't written it yet. And Aisha was like, yeah, so when am I going to get this 60-page script I have to learn? I'm like, you're going to get it tomorrow. Then she got it tomorrow. She got the first half, and then she, like, took the Thanksgiving break, basically. It was right around this time, and she... No, it's October right now. I was like, that's a lot. And then she learned the whole thing. We shot it in 3 days, and it was amazing.
So again, you sort of tell the network that you're going to do an entire show. Is that just, was it cool? Or was
no, but that's, we had 3 days and we had no more money. So they were like, I was like, oops, sorry guys, got to do it now. And they literally, I remember they called and they were like, they got the script and they were like, so let's first say this script is amazing. Are we really just going to have her talk the whole time? And I was like, yep. And they're like, okay, we thought there'd be like flashbacks in there. I was like, nope. I was like, she doesn't talk the whole time. The beginning, she's not talking. But again, it was like we were down to the wire, and either it was going to be a massive failure or it was going to be amazing. And for me, I'm like, if that's not the case, why are we doing it?
And it's interesting because the question then becomes, did you know? I mean, when you watched it and you're there on set, did you just know it was going to be amazing, or were you still?
It was a religious experience on set. Everybody was keyed in, everybody from directors, production, like literally this episode came together in less than a week. And it was at the point where the entire crew was exhausted. Like we had done it. We were like, we all hate each other. We want to go home. Then some magic happened with the script. We wrote it, and then everybody read it, and they were like, we're ready to do justice by this. And so when we were on set, and you know, everybody was there trying to be the team player for Aisha because she really had the lion's share of something to do. And because we did every act full take. And so she got up there, and she tells the story all the time that we were going to have an earpiece in her ear just in case she forgot lines, so I could be off camera being like, Harriet says this now. And we got there, and we all, the whole point was to make sure that there would be no sound in her ear with this thing. And we asked a million times. I get on set, I get there early to be like a good showrunner, and I'm like, there's no sound in the thing, let me check it. Put it in my ear, no sound. Like, good, we're good. She gets on set, they go to put the thing in the ear, and then they turn it on. And I'm like, so you didn't, when I put it in my ear, what did you think I was doing, guys? And so now there's a low buzz, and she's like, I can't have this in my ear while I'm trying to do it. So she takes it out. Like, we go over, her, me, and Anthony, and Joe pray. And then she goes up there. She does the first take, and after the first one, we went, we're going to be okay. This is going to work. It's going to be good. And then it was, and that's what it was. And it was just, it was amazing. But you don't know if that's going to translate to screen. Like, what we're feeling here might not be. And then we watched the first cut, and we went, oh, my God.
And, you know, it's interesting talking about Harriet Tubman, and sort of you start to see parallels between her and Rosalie in season two, was that always sort of the intention, that that the spirit of Harriet sort of in some ways gets infused into Rosalie? And
yeah, I mean, I think that was at the end of season one, going with her, meeting up with Harriet at the end of season one. We always had the intention from day one. I think that's why Journey, because Journey read, we have to put out sides. So we put out sides that was Rosalie in episode one, and then like this speech we had wrote for her at the end of the season. And she was like, oh, is this where the character's going? And I was like, uh-huh. She was like, yeah, sign me up. So yes, it was always the intention for her to become kind of our Harriet on the show.
Okay. Another scene that I really, really loved in that show was the scene with Bokeem Woodbine where he writes the love letter to his wife. And he hands the letter to her, and she obviously loves it, but she destroys it. And I'm interested to know, as you're sort of writing that scene and even sort of on set watching actors perform that scene, sort of where does that come from in the sense of sort of writing that love letter and having him give it to her? And
well, with Bokeem's character, we talked a lot about Frederick Douglass and teaching himself to read, and that idea just blows my mind personally, where I'm like, someone teaching themselves to read, knowing that this could get them killed. Like that, I'm just like, that simple thing every day I read, and I don't think twice about it. And here was a person who had to teach themselves to do that, and to teach themselves to do it knowing it could get them killed. Was the whole, you know, with Bokeem, the character and what we wanted to explore. And I think when you just take a moment to think about that, it just takes you in all these places. So I think it's that where we're like, okay, well, your wife would love this. She would love this. But at the same time,
she can't
love that. So.
And I love how you sort of planted that very early on in the season. And then obviously when we get to the end, here he is sort of almost being killed for that.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought that was great. So, you know, we get through season two, and I think there's that final moment where Noah basically looks at his son and he says, you know, you're never going to be a slave, basically. Mm-hmm. And obviously we know that that means there's something else coming, and the show's canceled. How do you, one, take that news, and then also sort of how is it to leave something that you know still has so much life within it?
I took it as it came because I really wasn't surprised. I mean, Sinclair Media had bought the network, they had canceled Outsiders. Like, it didn't surprise me. I wasn't like, oh my God, you canceled the show. I was surprised that no other network picked it up. I was very surprised by that. And then I went, why was I surprised by that? Misha, come on. You work in this business, you should know. And how do I take it? I take it as there's still more stories to tell in a variety of different ways. And, you know, I look at Underground and I go, it's insane that that is entirely everything I want it to be. And it's more insane considering the subject matter. So in that, I just go, okay, what do we got next?
But so you're working on a few other projects, mm-hmm. Lovecraft Country being one of those with Jordan Peele. Tell us a little bit about Lovecraft Country and working with Jordan, so as much as you can, I guess.
Lovecraft Country, it's set in 1954 in Jim Crow, and it follows kind of this group of Chicago Southsiders who discover this alternate America where all of the monsters in their pulp novels they read are real. So it's basically, I'm a huge genre fan. Horror is my favorite genre. And I now have the opportunity to have people color be heroes in genre space, which they haven't been typically the heroes of. They usually, you know, as when we pitched it to HBO, I said, this is the show where the black people don't die first. And so it's just really exciting, and it's really exciting to take Matt Ruff's novel, which is a great platform, and jump off that platform and do kind of any and everything genre.
And how is it sort of collaborating with Jordan Peele?
It's great. You know, Jordan, when we got the book and we started trying to get the book rights before, while I was still in season two of Underground and before Get Out had come out, and I watched a first cut of it and gave him some notes, and my notes were basically, don't let them f*** this up. It's good. And so it was that thing where they were like, Jordan's really into like horror right now. And I was like, the guy from Key and Peele? And then he was like, we know you love horror, and we've got this book, and we might be cool. You guys should meet. And then we met, and we just vibed right away.
And so where are we with Lovecraft Country? Have we sort of started the room? I kind of asked you that back there. So
yeah, we're going to start the room, the writer's room, in December, and then we're going to shoot it in February.
And so you already have a full series order for that?
Yeah, straight to series.
All right. And it's interesting. I was reading something that you wrote, and you were talking about how, one, every story is a personal story, but also you were saying how writers need to just love writing. Mm-hmm. And even if they're not being paid to write at this moment, they are writers. And I'm interested to sort of hear more about sort of how does one deal with, as a struggling writer, how do you just keep going when you just have all of these doors that are closing and all this rejection? Like, how does Misha deal with that?
You know, for me, I love writing. Again, it was always a hobby, so I don't see when I get notes, I don't see notes as problematic, because I'm just like, if they're good, we'll do them. If they're terrible, we won't. And I think that, again, it's a very selfish desire because I enjoy writing. Like when people say, you know, it's just so hard for me to get in front of that blank page, I'm like, I just don't experience that. I don't know that when I'm in front of the blank page, that's the only time I'm truly happy. So it's not a struggle. And I think that if you can find your way to how it's not a struggle, that's when you'll be successful. A lot of my process happens up here. Gotcha. And once we're in it, I can jump from script to script because I'm like, oh, I did the work already. Like what one of the things I told my mom, because she'd be like, what do you do all day? I was like, Mom, I work. I work 24/7 because I'm thinking about writing. I was like, so if we technically took it down to what work is, I work all the time. I never stop working. I was like, but that's part of the process. Like, I have to do all of that. Like, everybody's like, why can you write so fast? So I was like, because I've actually spent 3 months on this.
Do you think sort of not knowing the rules, per se, allows you to go in and just sort of do your thing?
I do. I think you have to a bit. You know, my sister said it once. She was like, Hollywood is the wild, wild west. And I was like, it really is. Like, you can do, again, if people think they will make money off of, and here's, I guess, the freedom I have as a writer is that I'm the first creator on anything. Like, I don't have to wait for anybody to allow me to do my thing. Gotcha. And they can't do their thing until my thing is finished. So for me, I go, I don't understand how writers aren't making billions of dollars. Like, this thing is created from the thing that I'm creating. So what? I'm supposed to be like, oh no, whatever you want, sure. No, you know better than me what this happened with this project. Nah, that seems crazy to me. And I don't like to live in crazy town.
On Story is brought to you in part by the Alice Kleberg Reynolds Foundation, a Texas family providing innovative funding since 1979. This project is supported in part by the Cultural Arts Division of the City of Austin Economic Development Department, the Texas Commission on the Arts, the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Services, Texas Library and Archives Commission, and by a grant from Applied Materials. This program is also made possible in part by a grant from Humanities Texas, the state affiliate for the National Endowment for the Humanities. The show is produced by myself, Barbara Morgan, as well as our associate producers, Aaron Halligan, Colin Heyer, Sonia Onescu, Maya Perez, and Brian Roberts. Our production coordinator is Ava Mites. Editing help from Jamal Knox. Music by Brian Ramos. Production assistance, KUT 90.5 in Austin. Go to austinfilmfestival.com to find out more about the Austin Film Festival and Conference in October. Until next time, I'm Barbara Morgan, and this has been Austin Film Festival's On Story.
PRI, Public Radio International.